Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey everybody, welcome to Movie Crush, Friday interview edition here, well, not here with Cole Stratton. You are in Los Angeles, right?
That's right, home of earthquakes, judging by last
night. Yeah, you guys had an earthquake last night. Tell me about it. I was going to ask you about that.
It wasn't that big. It was like 3.1 or something, but I was only a couple miles away from the epicenter, so it felt pretty legit. We were just sitting on the couch watching the first episode of Lock and Key because we decided to dive into that, and it just did its thing where, you know, swayed for about 15, 20 seconds. There's been quite a few in the last, like, year or so, so that's getting slightly alarming, but they've never really scared me. But it was legit.
You know, man, I lived there for about 5 years, and I never felt so much as a tremble. And it was, it's kind of one of those things where you obviously don't want anything bad to happen, but you kind of want to know what it feels like.
Yeah. I mean, I usually don't feel them up to this past year when they've become, like, a lot more prevalent and, like, have happened during the day. Like, I just don't feel them half the time. And of course, you just go to Twitter or whatever to find out if legit it happened, because then everybody in the world's tweeting about it in the LA area. But right. But yeah, I mean, I didn't feel them. I usually don't feel them. But the last couple I have, I think mostly because they've been pretty significantly rocking. So.
And the other ones you just feel emotionally?
Yeah, you bet. It gets me right here.
So Cole is an improv comedian. You do some acting as well, right?
Yeah, a little bit here and there.
And you are someone who I met through San Francisco Sketchfest. You were one of the co-founders of Sketchfest, along with Janet Varney and I think one other person, right?
Yeah, David Owen were the three that started it in 2002. So
that's crazy, man. I don't know if I've met David. Is he still a part of it?
Yeah, he's around. We're just, because we have a billion shows happening, odds are you guys have not been in the same building at the same time.
Yeah, it is crazy big and really successful. For my money, the best comedy festival in the country. And I would love to hear a little bit about how that started out in your relationship with Janet as well.
Yeah, sure. So we're coming up on our 20th festival in theory in January, who knows with the way things are going in the world right now. But back in 2002, we started it. Janet, me, Dave, and this other guy, Gabe, were in a sketch group together called Totally False People. We all met at San Francisco State. We started doing sketch together. And there wasn't really a lot of places to do sketch in San Francisco. There was a couple of kind of janky venues. One was called the Mott Cafe that had like a beam in the middle of the room, so the sight lines were not great. If you did sketch at like comedy clubs, it was very confusing for people. I remember we did a gig in Rooster Teeth Feathers because Gabe's mom owned it at the time. And we did like a 20-minute opening set for something. And I remember some guy like called and left a message on the voicemail being like, I don't know what they were doing, stage acting or something. So it was kind of hard to find a place to do the stuff. So there was a couple other sketch teams in town that were kind of in a similar boat. So we kind of banded together and we rented a theater because you couldn't do a one-off in a theater. You had to like kind of rent for a month. So
yeah.
We rented the Shelton Theater in Union Square, which is 75 seats, and the six teams decided to kind of do two groups a night, co-headlining with an intermission, and then the last week, like kind of cabaret style, where all six teams did like 15-minute sets instead of 45-minute sets, like that. And we had no idea if it would work, and we just decided to give it a shot. And thankfully, the San Francisco Chronicle ran a date book story on it back when print like really did a lot for you.
Yeah.
And it was front page on the Thursday date book section, and it kind of took off. We sold out every single show but one.
Wow.
And the one we didn't sell out had like 10 tickets left. So that's where we kind of figured like, oh, this thing could actually be something. We had really no intentions of it becoming an actual festival. That was just kind of the guise to put it under in order for all six of us to kind of cross-pollinate our own audiences and find some new ones.
Yeah, that was kind of my question was whether or not you guys were like, you know, maybe we should try it again next year. I mean, did it kind of grow organically?
Yeah, the next year we just decided we could kind of go to a bigger venue. So we rented the Eureka Theater, which is now the Gateway, but it's been one of our venues since year two. It's the longest tenured venue at this point. And it's 200 seats up from the 75 in Shelton. And so we decided to do that, and we kind of opened it up to other sketch teams in the country. You could kind of submit, mm-hmm. send a video in back when everybody sent in VHSs. And we went after some headliners, like just thinking, why not? Can't hurt to ask. And we managed to somehow get UCB, the three guys, to come and do a sketch show and an improv show. Wow. Mm-hmm. Fred Willard and his Hollywood Players, which is a sketch team that Fred was kind of in charge of. So those two were like kind of the first to really take a chance on us. And then we just kind of built it out from there, and just every year kind of added a few more venues or a few more headliners. And after five or 6 years, we just realized that sketch was very finite. So we decided to open it up to all forms of comedy, and just kind of went from there.
Man, that is amazing. I mean, if you've never been to Sketchfest, you're missing out. It is is it just in the month of January now?
Yeah, that's when the festival itself is proper. We sometimes do programming throughout the year, a little bit here and mm-hmm. a little bit there. Sometimes we usually book the Comedy Tent and Outside Lands, which is a big music festival there. And we were working with Clusterfest the last couple of years, too. We've done some summer events at the Castro Theater and things like that, too. But yeah, the bulk of what we do is in January.
Yeah, it's amazing. If you've never been, you should go. It is a month of some of the best. I mean, you guys have gotten to the point now where you just kind of own the city of San Francisco for a month. I feel like dozens of venues. How many venues do you have going?
We have, it kind of varies per year, but I think we're usually around 20. We've had as many as like 22, wow. 23. Like on any given Friday night, say like at 8 o'clock, there are probably 12 shows going on at the same time against each other. And, you know,
that's the only shitty part. As a performer, it's like, oh man, I want to be doing this. I want to be doing this. And it's just, you can't get it all in. So you go and you see what you can see. And you sacrifice by doing your own performances when you'd rather be going somewhere else to watch somebody. And you guys are getting, I mean, you do these big tributes now. You've had these legends like Carol Burnett. And I know Jeff Goldblum was there last year, I think, or 2 years ago.
Yeah, he's done his kind of fun, weird music jazz thing he does where he sings songs, but then he also comes out and does like music trivia or movie trivia on his own movies and stuff. And it's really funny and silly. But yeah, at this point, like early on, we were just kind of like, there's no way anybody would do this thing. You know, in our minds, it's like, we're just a bunch of college kids, which was really all we were. We had no knowledge of this stuff. But I think the reason we've been able to survive and actually thrive as long as we have is that the three of us came there as performers, but mm-hmm. we all have good heads for business. So it's that combination of knowing what the performers want to get out of it and what audiences want to get out of it. So hopefully the performers come and have a good time. The audiences have a good time, and it's kind of symbiotic and it goes from there. And I think Fred Armisen once said it's like comedy summer camp, which we kind of lean on that quote a lot, because it kind of is like any given weekend because of the volume of shows we have. There's so many performers in town and so many people are friends with each other, and they just don't get to hang out that often because they're not in the same town. So that's kind of the fun part of it is at the end of the night at the parties, you know, at midnight, there's like 100 people in a room that all barely see each other. And are excited to come together and kind of cross-pollinate each other's shows and stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, man. It's I think Stuff You Should Know has been there for maybe 5 years straight or at least four.
I think so, yeah.
And it's always, you know, one of our favorite things to do every year. And we get to see all of our friends because you guys are kind enough to book us of the weekend where, you know, where Colton and Hodgman and Ben Acker and the guys are all there and Adam Pranica and Ben Harrison. So we're all of our buddies are kind of all there at the same time. Paul F. Tompkins. And it's just sort of a fun weekend of celebration with each other. It's really, really great.
Yeah, we love it. We were pretty cognitive of that, like when we put stuff together of like, okay, well, that'll be the weekend of all the thrilling people, all the podcasts on Maximum Fun, all that kind of stuff, because you guys all want to be there at the same time, which is cool. And that's always the weird thing is like there's three kind of weekends. So we have shows on weeknights too. We only stay dark on Mondays if we can. And sometimes we can't. We could do Carol Burnett on a Monday because that's when she could do.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of like a different weekend for each of these performers that are coming through. So, but yeah, we try to put the same kind of folk on the same weekend, which also sometimes sucks because we have to program shows that have a very similar audience base at the same time. And it's kind of, you got to choose one. Sorry, audience, or whatever.
I know. I mean, it's an embarrassment of riches when you get to that point, you know?
Yeah.
Who's the biggest? I know Carol Burnett was a really big deal. Who for you has been kind of the coolest, biggest person in your life that you've been able to meet and work with there?
God, it's been crazy. I mean, early on for us, it was Kids in the Hall because they were kind of our heroes. And kind of a goal of ours was to get the Kids in the Hall to our festival. So we kind of got them individually first, like Bruce McCullough came and did one of his solo shows. And Foley, I think, came and did that too. And then Scott came and did something. And then Kevin did something. And then I think Mark was the last one we got when we did a full Kids in the Hall, like sketch live sketch show and a tribute where we had them in conversation. And I remember there's a moment where they had a big suite over at the Marriott, which was like our sponsor hotel that one year only, but we used them that one year. And I remember all of us were up there hanging out in this big like suite at the Marriott with the Kids in the Hall and being like, okay, we're here now. So
yeah, that is amazing. I was on the elevator with Bruce McCullough one year and I just like, I couldn't even say anything. And I'm usually pretty good about that, but I froze up.
It's funny because like he and Janet are pretty good friends. And I remember once we went and saw the National at the Hollywood Bowl and Bruce came with Janet. And afterwards, when we were leaving, he had a backpack on and a ball cap and he looked just like Gavin, his character. And it was just hard to not like the National weighs 8.5 pounds.
Yeah. Did he have cabbage on his head?
Pretty much. So, yeah, so that was early on. That was a big one for me. Since then, like, we've gotten so many of our heroes. And Carol Burnett, obviously, was huge. Alan Arkin was one of my, like, heroes.
Oh, yeah.
So we've had him. Like, my white whale right now is Albert Brooks because he's my comedy hero. Never had him. But we've been trying, and I think one year we will. I mean, he's interested. It just hasn't worked out yet. But, it's been crazy the amount of people we've gotten there. And it's gotten... I don't get starstruck anymore because of the volume in which we get these people over. I mean, obviously there's some people that I'm a little more like, I'm just going to say hello and shake their hands and that's it. Goodbye. Like, right. I'm not going to try to strike up a conversation, but it's pretty crazy. It's very surreal every year.
Yeah, man, that's awesome. I mean, just what you guys have managed to put together is just amazing. And it's one of those festivals that's just, there's a good vibe everywhere you go. It's staying in that hotel is fun because like you never know who's going to cruise through that lobby or be on the elevator with you. And it's all very chill and, you know, probably because it's San Francisco and it's just a great vibe. I have a great time every single year. I hope you guys keep inviting us.
No, we definitely will. That's one of the wonderful things about the festivals. We finally get somebody for the first time and then most of the time they want to come back and then they become staple of the festival year after year. So,
yeah, it's cool. And our listeners look forward to us coming every January at the Castro. And Janet has... I've told her this too. She has always pushed me to do things that I didn't think I could do. And I got to do the In Conversation with the Baskets TV show.
Right.
And so I was on stage with Zach and Louis Anderson and just like, that was a huge career moment for me. And I just thank you guys for letting me be a part of it.
Of course. Yeah. It's crazy very how cool. far Janet's come. I mean, like I just remember back when we were doing sketch together, she was selling furniture. Like that's what she did. And going to school, she had transferred from Arizona where she's from and stuff. And so she was very, very shy about it. Like she didn't have a lot of confidence at first. And I just remember I wrote for her a lot because I thought she was really funny. And like it took her a little while to like, believe it. And then once she did, she's amazing. And she always has been. And lo and behold, she's the one that really took off and has an amazing career. And I still get to work with her all the time. I see her less here in LA, even though we both live here, than when we're in San Francisco, because she's on the east side, I'm on the west side, which so you might as well be like New York, LA at that point.
No, totally.
It's so far, but
How far west are you?
I am in Century City. So kind of near that mall.
Gotcha.
So I like it a lot. It's like Central West Side. The only thing that's hard to get to is like Burbank because there's no real, I got to go around or over, but it's pretty easy to get to Santa Monica, pretty easy to get into Hollywood. So I like it a lot.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. Where are you from originally?
I was born in East Lansing. So I grew up in Okemos, Michigan.
Okay.
Lived there till I was 9. And then my mom, she worked at Michigan State and then she got basically the same job, but at UC Davis for like double the salary or whatever. So it was like, okay, pack up the camper. Here we go to California. We moved out to Davis, California, which is where my folks still are and where most of my formative years are from 9 through, you know, end of high school. And that's where I still go back for holidays and stuff. And then it was San Francisco after that.
Yeah, that's interesting you mentioned that age range because that's sort of where I like to talk to people about their formative movie-going years, which for me are like 10 or 11 through, you know, 17 or 18. What movies were you into? Was this something that you were always, because I've seen, you know, we're on Facebook together, and I see you have an amazing collection of movie posters that you display regularly on Facebook, and it's truly impressive. And so I know you're a really big movie buff. Was that always your bag?
Yeah, always. I like to say I'm a child of HBO.
You and me both,
know,
man.
Because, like, you know, I was born in 76, so, like, you know, mid 80s was really like when my film stuff started happening. And my dad was like really into movies and stuff too, and he passed down a lot of classic films. So I was getting both the HBO things that I watched all the time. So there's a good 20 movies or so that, like, I will defend to the end of time. I know they're not great movies necessarily, but I've seen Girls Just Want to Have Fun and Cloak and Dagger and the pirate movie and The Last Unicorn a million times.
Yeah.
So I love those things to death. And I get that. You know, for me, the 80s are the sweet spot. That's all the stuff that, like, I have such romance for, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And then the 90s is really where I started to kind of go into exploring all sorts of film. I worked at indie video stores for, like, 15 years in San Francisco, and then even down here when I first moved here. So I was really into physical media. I still have, like, 2,000 Blu-rays and DVDs.
Nice.
So, which is, you know, they're not all on streaming, people. I know you think that they are, but they're not.
Yeah, I think you're speaking to the heart of many Movie Crush listeners, because there are a lot of people that have vast libraries and take it pretty seriously. I know what you're talking about with the HBO. There were, I call them HBO movies. I mean, they were movies. They weren't made by HBO, but they were movies that I watched just incessantly just because they were on. And in that same gap, I think I'm about 5 years older than you, but it's that same window of time where HBO came into your house, and between that and MTV, like, it changed my life.
Oh yeah, fully. I mean it's funny because I don't watch cable that much even anymore, even though I have a billion channels, and I'll flip around. I'll just put movies on if I'm working, because I work from home for the festival. Sometimes I'm just doing a lot of busy work on my computer, and, like, if there's certain movies that if they're just on cable, I'll just leave them on in the background. I just won't ever change off them. Like Mr. Mom or Major League or whatever. Like, they just will constantly be on, because Silverado, like, they're just things that I just love. And it doesn't matter what part it is, because I've seen them a bunch of times. It's like, oh, cool. I'll just pick it up right here. Awesome. So, yeah, but HBO definitely was the one. I still, like, love – I have that theme song stuck in my head still.
Oh, God.
So, yeah.
That was the best.
That flying HBO symbol that would come over town. Yeah.
Yeah, someone posted that on our Facebook page, the Movie Crush one, the other day, and it's just – it's impossible to see that and not just be awash in a wave of nostalgia.
Yeah. And I think what was great about that time and what's confusing about this time is you didn't have choices. And I like that. Yeah. Like, you had choices, but you didn't have what you have now, which is like needles and haystacks of needles. Whereas before, it's like, you know, you had a pitchfork, so you could at least bail through the hay. So, like, now movies come out and it's like you don't – you look at the cast, like, how have I not heard of this? How is this not in the theaters? That kind of thing.
Yeah, totally.
Whereas back then, it's like – movies came out in the theater. There was like three or four that opened on a weekend. And then it used to take like 6 months to a year for it to come out on VHS. Like, you had a legit amount of time to wait for the movies. Now it's like, if you don't see it in the theater, you're like, oh, it'll be on demand in like 3 weeks or whatever.
Right.
Which is crazy. Yeah. So, like, that was, and when VHS came out, they cost $99. So you had to wait for them to get to price to own. So it was so crazy like that. It was just like a different pace of living. Everything was slower. And if you think about it, even though at that time the generation before was saying, like, stop living so fast with your VCRs and whatever. But it used to be that you would call somebody, you'd leave a message on their message machine. And then when they called you, you called them back the next day, or they called you back the next day. You're like, thanks for calling me back so quick.
Right.
Now it's like, I texted you 15 minutes ago. Are you dead?
I know. What the fuck is wrong?
Right.
Do you have COVID-19?
Exactly. So it's just, I kind of miss that time. I miss that kind of, like, slower pace of everything, even though there's still a lot happening. But, and I think that enabled me to, like, watch movies and not think about it, just, like, enjoy them and be able to relax. Now it just feels like there's something I should be doing. And it's harder for me to, like, want to sit down and watch movies as much. I feel guilty when I do it. I still watch a ton of movies, so don't get me wrong, but it doesn't have the same kind of childhood glee that it once did.
Yeah. And I talk a lot about, certainly great movies in the 1960s and 1970s, some of the most iconic films ever. But I talk a lot about just like 1982 or 1983. If you go back, and occasionally someone will scan in like the newspaper movie section from that one of those years, and it's staggering the quality of 75% of the movies that came out were just really good movies. I mean, they might not be the biggest blockbusters or these iconic films, but movies like, you know, Absence of Malice or The Verdict, like these, I call them adult films, like adult dramas that you just don't see enough of anymore. It's really, and I don't want to be the old guy that's talking about how, you know, things in my day were so much better, but I think week to week, every Friday, there were a couple of really good movies that would come out, it felt like.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think movies were built different then. I mean, if you go back to the old Hollywood system, they're all built kind of on a formula, but the formula was like, take your time, hit these marks or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the auteur stuff happened with, you know, Easy Rider and Godfather and all that stuff, Scorsese. And then the kind of the studio system kind of got freaked out. But so then it was kind of a clash between that where indie film and the system and stuff after that. But I just feel like there, if you, yeah, you look like 82, 83, 84. I mean, 84 is kind of when all the blockbustery stuff started happening because you had Gremlins and Ghostbusters and all that kind of stuff.
I think Raiders, was that 84 or was that?
I think it was. It might have been 82.
Was that 82?
I think that was 82. Yeah. But like that's kind of, I mean, obviously Jaws is the first, like the thing that set the whole blockbuster chain going. But I just kind of feel like then it was more tentpole summer event movies from that point on. And then, like, the art films would still open or they would still be there because the studios had prestige films they wanted to get out there in addition to their popcorn movies.
Yeah.
And now it's, like, every weekend, it's, like, you're lucky if you live in a town that will get the movies that aren't the big studio movies that play on 3,000 screens.
Yeah. That's where you kind of have to look these days, I think. Or, I mean, there are still some good studio films, but there are few and far between that aren't Marvel movies. I mean, I love those movies, but you have to kind of look to the indie world a little more, do a little more curating and searching. I feel like you could write a book about this kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean,
you ever thought about that?
I thought about doing some sort of podcast on 80s movies and stuff, especially where I thought I would just like take a movie and really deconstruct it and be like, here's the audio from the trailer. This is how they did it. Here's the marketing. Here's that stuff, because it's really fascinating, especially if you like most of those old trailers are on YouTube and other places, too. If you just look them up, or if you end up down the rabbit hole, Siskel and Ebert reviews, that's always fun because like it's just fun to see what they thought of things at the time, because time and distance from movies, it's just good. Weird to see how things were received initially versus now. Movies that are classics were like panned and that kind of stuff too. But it's weird to look back on all how that all went. But the trailers are great too, in that like they did voiceover on almost all of them, and they don't do that anymore. It's just like music. You're lucky if you get In a World. Even In a World is an old troupe now. But most of like if you look back on those 80s movies especially, it's always just like Charlie Babbitt is a wonderful lawyer. But he's about to have the weekend from hell. Like they literally spell it all out for you.
Yeah, those were great.
And they just don't do it anymore. And then like the voices used to be not the Fred Melamuds, not the like the low like In a World where blah blah blah.
Yeah,
it was more conversational. It was like different. It's just different, and it's just interesting to see it now, because if you play one of those trailers now before a movie, people would laugh at it. They'd be like, "That's so cheesy. It doesn't make me want to see it. I don't get it all." But that's what it was. Like, it's just weird how much things have changed to be slick and evoke certain feelings and not actually tell you kind of what the movie is half the time.
Yeah, and this leads me to the movie posters in your collection. I think we can both agree that movie posters nowadays are awful.
Terrible.
And yeah, they're fucking terrible and so formulaic and with all the faces. And you've got a really great collection of both foreign, not foreign films, but foreign versions of American movies, which is really fun. The first time I traveled to Europe, I took a lot of pictures of European versions of American movie posters and the titles. But when did that start? And what is your collection all about to you?
So, I mean, I love the alternative, any alternative artwork for posters I love, because there's a certain thing you've seen a billion times, but when you see a different country's take on it or different, I just love it. And how the titles are different and stuff too. I just find them entertaining as hell. But for me, like, I was just obsessed with movies growing up. So my room was just covered in movie posters that I got as like free from the video store that I would just frequent. And I even had a couple of the cardboard standees, like the big ones, because when they were going to toss them out, they would give them to me. So in my room, I had Willow, Broadcast News, and Dirty Dancing. And you don't you don't see a lot of, like, you know, 10-year-old kids with a Broadcast News standee.
Right.
But and that's like, that's my second favorite movie. Like, I love it to death. But it's just one of those – I just loved it all. And I would just – like, the room I was given, we moved into our place in Davis, I think was like a little girl's room at the time. So it had, like, strawberry wallpaper. It's just weird. It wasn't – I didn't love it. So I just like covering it up with movie posters. Uh-huh. I just plastered over it. So I had so many, and then I would just, you know, get something new and replace it. But I didn't like protect them. They were just taped up there. Like, there's no thought in them about value. It was just like, this is cool. And I just think back, they're so weird too. Like, I had Nadine up there with Jeff Bridges and Kim Bish. Like, what is that? But it was just like, I like those actors. This is a cool looking poster. Why not? And I would just keep constantly cycle through it. So I think I always kind of had that. And then as I started to kind of really get serious about movies, because I technically went to San Francisco State for film. I was enrolled in the film program there. My degree is in cinema with an emphasis on direction. Fat lot of good I'm doing with that. But but it was different then too, because the film, I learned to edit on a flatbed. Like, it wasn't digital.
Yeah.
So it was just
same here.
Different. It was just, you know, you'd go back and you'd look at the film, and what you thought was fast wasn't fast because you were cranking it too fast. And then you look at it and you're like, oh my God, this is the slowest cut thing in the history of the world.
Yeah.
But it was just a different, like, feeling. So as I started to go through that, and I started to work at indie video stores and stuff too, I would start to get posters that were like, I used to get reproductions because I didn't really think much like about value of it. So I had like a Goldfinger poster on my wall, like the British UK quad version, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I just started kind of getting excited about these like foreign film posters I would find for American movies and stuff. And I just started collecting them. And at first I would put them up, but now I have hundreds. So a couple years ago, I realized these are just sitting in a closet. I should just take these all out, photograph them, and then periodically post them on my socials as a way of hanging them without hanging them.
Yeah.
And I still have a bunch.
I love it, man.
Thanks. Thanks.
And it's great.
It's not hard to find them. Like, you can go on eBay and just, you know, literally just look at originals, non-US years or whatever, and just kind of scroll through. And some stuff is ridiculously expensive, but I'll order like, you know, 20 from Australia that are ranging from like $3 to $10 each. And then ends up being just like, you know, $150 or whatever. And I got a bunch of cool posters. So they're all out there, and they're undervalued a lot of the time, especially if you like movies that aren't the big blockbusters.
Yeah. What is your most prized possession? I know that's a tough one. Or do you have a,
ooh, that's tough. It might be, I have some that are signed by people that I got either through the festival or my podcast or whatever. I have a Swedish Young Frankenstein poster signed by Gene Wilder. We did a kind of a tribute to him. It ended up being a post-festival event because he could only come in March to time with the book release. So we did like a book release signing and a screening of Young Frankenstein and then like a conversation Q&A with him. And it was just like magical. Wow. And while the film ran, we all went and got dinner. And that's like probably the most surreal night of my life.
Wow.
Six top of us. It was like Gene and his wife and me, Janet and Dave and Sydney Goldstein, who used to run City Arts and Lectures, who passed away a couple of years ago, and her husband. And we were just, you know, just there chatting. And I wasn't, there's somebody between me and him, so I wasn't talking to him that much, but we rode over together. And, you know, what do you talk about on a car ride with Gene Wilder? He just kind of asked about the rates of houses in San Francisco, I think. And expensive is the answer. But it was crazy. And there's been a few nights like that. Like, we went and we got beers with Terry Jones after we did Holy Grail and stuff. And, like, you know, this was about 5 or 6 years before the dementia set in. And then he passed recently, too. So there's just things like that that are just, like, these are things that people nowadays would, like, have to win. And like one of those, like, buy $300 worth of things and one person will win this thing. And these are just things we got to do. And it's just crazy to me. And I'm just glad that, like, I'm somebody who would appreciate it. Because there's people that get that shit all the time that don't, which is crazy to me.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. Gene Wilder, Boy, that's special. He's up there for me. That would have been intimidating. Everything I've heard about him is that he was the biggest sweetheart of a man in the history of the world, you know?
Yeah, he was very soft-spoken and gentle and sweet and funny, still very, was very sharp and funny then. I think he had already retired from acting, or I think he was doing a couple of those like TV mystery things for that character like he liked to do, but that was it. He hasn't done any features after that. I know Spielberg was trying to coax him out of retirement to do Ready Player One.
Oh, wow.
Yep, which would have been crazy, but I think he was in ill health then, and I don't think he wanted that to get out, because I think he died like 6 months or a year later or something, but... he was trying to get him out for that. And that would have been crazy.
Yeah. Jeez. That's unbelievable. He would have been, I don't know what I would have said to Gene Wilder. I would have been super intimidated.
It's crazy. Cause you don't want to talk about their work. Cause obviously they've talked about their work a billion times.
I know.
Even though you would love to be like, what was it like working with Pryor? What was it? You know, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, Mel Brooks, I know you that you like Mel didn't find putting on the Ritz funny, but you did. How did you fight for that? Or whatever. But, you know, you don't want to come at them as a fanboy. You want to come at them as a peer at the best, you know, like, or just somebody that he can talk to. He can be free. He can take off his persona that a lot of actors and stuff have to do, and just like chat about whatever you want to chat about, you know, whether that's other movies or whether that's the weather, or it doesn't matter.
I think I would have to break protocol a little bit, though, because I wouldn't want to come across as indifferent to who he is as well. So I would have to sneak in something about Blazing Saddles or Willy Wonka or speaking of HBO movies of that era, The Woman in Red was a movie I probably saw 13 times as a youth.
All the Charles Grodin blind stuff in that movie just kills me. It's so good. He was just so good. I mean, even in his like movies that were kind of panned as lesser work, so to speak, like Haunted Honeymoon or Hanky Panky. Like, those were HBO movies. I watched the hell out of Haunted Honeymoon. So
yeah, no, just, I totally did too.
There's people you'll watch in anything. It doesn't matter what they're in. It's just a joy to see them on screen. And he was one of them.
That is amazing. So before we get going with the movie, I do want to cover really quickly. I saw on Facebook the past few days, You have watched the Bad Boys movies.
Oh, yeah.
movies that I have never seen. I worked with Michael Bay one time. I was a PA on a TV commercial that he directed, and it was one of the most interesting, enjoyable, and surreal commercial shoots I've ever been on. But what were those movies like? Are they any good?
You know, it's weird. I've seen most everything in that era, you know, working at video stores, I would just put shit on in the background, if anything.
Yeah.
But I somehow had just never seen the Bad Boys movies. I was always aware of them, but just had never put them in. I think
same
I missed
here.
The first one. And then when the second one came out, I was like, well, I didn't see the first one. And at that time, it was a little harder to kind of, they weren't playing on TV and I didn't really want to rent it or whatever. So I just finally decided, my wife and I were just talking and I was like, you know, I've never seen the Bad Boys movies. She's like, I haven't either. And I was like, well, I guess we should watch the Bad Boys movies.
And now's the time,
now's
my
the
friend.
Time. I was like, yeah, the time. And they're on Netflix, the first two. And the third one just became rentable on iTunes. So we watched them. And it's weird because, you know, I'll get – people will write about my movie picks when I put them up there, my posters or whatever. And, like, right now I'm doing this quarantine film fest thing that I just decided to do, where I'm, like, pick – like, 30 of your favorite movies, one movie a day. I'm not necessarily watching them now. I'm just, like, posting one a day just to be like, I love this movie and whatever. But – those would get some responses, but the Bad Boys thing has caused a lot of conversation on my wall because people love those movies. Like, and I realize it's for people a bit younger than me that like the 90s were their HBO movies, so to speak. And so that for them was huge because the first one came out in 95, which means I was like in my second year of college. And it went 95, 2003, 2020, like most trilogies do.
Yeah.
The first one to me, like that's – everybody kept saying watch two, watch two. Two's the best one. Watch two, watch two. Which it's always annoying when you get that for series or things like that too. Like, oh, don't, the first season of Buffy's terrible, but season two is great. But you need to watch season one. But, you know, so I gotta suffer through 12 terrible episodes to get to where it's good. Well, do appreciate where it's good. Oh, okay, whatever.
Right.
So we watched Bad Boys and like I thought it was just okay. Like I didn't – it has a conceit in it, a plot mechanic that I hate. It's one of my pet peeves in movies which is Mistaken Identity, and it goes on for fucking ever. It's one of these things where, like, she only will deal with Mike Lowry, and that's Will Smith, and, like, she gets Martin Lawrence, and he's, like, has to pretend he's Mike Lowry and takes her back to his apartment, and it's pictures of him, of Will Smith everywhere, and she thinks he's gay because, you know, gay panic's still happening in the 90s. And
it's Three's Company.
Yeah, exactly. And Three's Company's fine for what Three's Company is.
No, I love Three's Company, but sure, right. I get what you're saying.
But this drags on for over an hour of the Mistaken Identity thing. And I was like, this would have been a good scene or two. This would have been a good 10 minutes. And I always get frustrated in movies where a simple conversation clears things up. I just, I hate it. Hate it when, like I always think about Shrek as an example of, like, he's about to tell her how he feels and he goes to the door to knock, and then she's saying something out of context and he hears that, and so he doesn't knock and he walks away. I hate
that. Three's Company.
So much. It frustrates me. So that, so watching that movie, I just was just getting frustrated with it. I was like, okay, just say, like, I'm his partner. Like, he will be here tomorrow. Would you rather go outside and get shot at? Like, that would have sufficed, but they wanted to mine the comedy out of it, which then took away the logic. And, like, I'm fine with things being brainless action movies. I love them. But at a certain point, when you're, this is just going on and on and on, I was just like, oh my God, clear it up, please. And let's move forward to the third act. So I didn't love the first one. I thought it was fine. I just didn't, I thought their chemistry was good and stuff. And I could see, like, okay, this has potential. But then everybody was saying, watch two, watch two, watch two. So we watched two. It's like 2.5 hours long, which...
Bay movies are way too long.
Yeah, does not need to be. And it's way over the top. It's better. It's shot better. The action sequences are more exciting. The camaraderie is better in a sense too. But it's still, like, very uneven and, like, still ridiculous lapses in logic per usual. But that's fine. I don't mind that. But then it felt like, okay, we should watch three. Three just got rentable yesterday. So we should complete the trilogy and watch that one. And honestly, I might have liked it the best only because I saw them all at once and it's a little more of a modern sensibility now, I think.
Yeah.
It's a little more grounded in logic, even though it's still ridiculous. But I don't know. I thought it was pretty good. And I would give them all like 2.5 stars out of 5. Like that's kind of where they sit. That's kind of where they sit with me, you know, like moments, good moments, but I don't have the same emotional attachment to them as people that were raised on them or grew up with them that will forgive those things because it meant a lot to them when they were 12. You know, I didn't have that, but there are definitely little holes here and there of movies like that, that I haven't seen. And periodically I realize it and I'm like, all right, I'll go, I have the time now. I'll go back and check them out and see what I was missing.
Yeah, I've got a lot of those holes. There's a whole spate of movies from the 90s that, because those were, you know, my college years as well. And I certainly went to a lot of movies and I worked at the Cool Video Store, but I didn't go see everything that came out because, you know, when you're in college, you're just doing a lot of other stuff.
Right.
And I never saw any of those movies. I never saw any of the, and people can't believe that I've never seen any of the Happy Madison movies or the Spade Farley movies. I've never seen any of those. I never saw the Jackie Chan, Owen Wilson stuff. What were those?
Shanghai Noon and Shanghai Nights.
Yeah, I didn't see those. Are they good?
I think they're really good. Yeah. I mean, at least the first one is. I think it's a fun comedy. And like the Happy Madison, like Happy Gilmore, Billy Madison, all that stuff. Like those were in college for me. I watched those in college. I love them. I still have a spot for them, but I realize they're not great movies. I recognize that, but
I don't know why I didn't see those.
Well, it's also weird too. Cause like Tommy Boy is fantastic. I think it still holds up. It's very funny, but then Black Sheep, which was right afterwards, is pretty abysmal. And so it's just weird how things can be like really hit and miss with the same, you know, set of people. But yeah, I can see like, if you just miss those, it's hard to want to go back and watch those. Though people will quote them around you all the time, and then you feel like you get a little bit of FOMO.
I think I should probably go back and watch Tommy Boy. I've seen parts of a lot of these movies. Which was the golf one? Was that Happy Gilmore?
That's Happy Gilmore, yeah.
I feel like I've seen most of that, but I never, definitely never just sat down to watch that or saw it in a theater. And I like Sandler. I'd certainly like what we're getting these days from him a lot more.
Yeah.
But now's the time. Maybe I should just go start watching all those sort of popcorn Hollywood movies from the 90s.
Sandler had such a weird trajectory to me in that, like, you know, all the college bros and stuff loved those movies when they first came out. And like those two, especially Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, are like so goofy and so silly and so many non sequiturs and things that don't make any sense whatsoever. They're just bits or whatever, but they're funny and they're very juvenile. And then Wedding Singer happened, and he started to get a little, it was a little more serious in a sense. It was still a comedy.
I think I did see that one. Yeah.
It was still a comedy, but he was kind of acting a little bit in it, you know? Waterboy's silly too. But then Punch Drunk Love happened, and it became like, oh, Sandler is an actor. He's not just like a goofball.
Right.
And then for a while after that, he was doing the Jim Carrey thing of like serious stuff only. And then you were kind of like, make goofy movies again.
Yeah.
And then he went to seriously goofy, like maybe the worst goofy movies and like the Netflix ones he was doing, Ridiculous Six and all that kind of stuff.
And then, Little Nicky, I never saw, but that was supposed to be really bad, wasn't it?
Yeah, that though is 90s in a time capsule. That is like probably the most 90s movie that exists. Like, watch it. It is so 90s. The soundtrack really? Alone, like, it just goes song to song to song. It's just, if Incubus was a movie, it's Little Nicky.
Oh, that's good stuff, man. I feel like we could just talk about random movies forever. Maybe you can become like a regular guest and we could do some more fun stuff like this.
That'd be great, man.
That'd be a lot of fun. I think we will move on to Searching for Bobby Fischer, which was your pick as your favorite film. This is a movie from 1993, I think, right?
Yeah, 93.
That I saw when it came out in 93. I was in college in Athens, and it's not a movie that I'm not sure why I saw it in the theater at the time, because it's not a college movie that I would have drawn me to the theater for some reason. But I got to watch it again this morning, and it's just purely magical in every way.
It's magic
so
in a bottle.
Great.
And I don't know why you would see it in college. It's not like you're like, bros, you guys want to go see this father-son bonding chess prodigy movie? Oh, like there's no reason you would do that.
I don't know why I did. I'm pretty sure I saw it in the theater, but I know I definitely saw it very soon on VHS if that wasn't the case. But tell me about your first experience with the movie and why. Before we kind of dig into it, what it means to you and why it's your favorite movie.
Well, it was definitely VHS for me because I missed it in the theaters. Because it didn't, I mean, I looked up some stuff on it and like it opened at number 19 its first weekend.
Yeah.
It had the third highest per screen average, but it was not on a lot of screens. And that's when like Fugitive is really in the box office and like Jason Goes to Hell opened that weekend. So that was number two. Like it was 19. So like it wasn't really widespread and I didn't think to go see it, even though I love all the people in it, especially now. If you look back, it's like character actor bonanza.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
But I think we rented it and I put it in and it was just like from frame one, I was just like my jaw just dropped. Like the feel of it to me is like the most like consistently magical. There's no tone issues whatsoever. It has a tone and it just nails it. And it's just like, it's perfect because it has every emotion in it to me. Like it's sad at times. It's funny at times. It's very touching. It's feel good. It's just like kind of everything. And, you know, I'm not like a chess guy, you know, like
I was going to ask you that if that had anything to do with it.
I played chess a little bit, but like, I'm just okay at it. Like, I never bothered to learn theory or like, you know, move kind of stuff. It was just like, let's just play. And if somebody was too good, I'd be like, well, this is pointless. I'm like, I don't care about learning that much. But, you know, I like chess fine. I played like battle chess on my PC and whatever else. But I think it was just like, I always tell people that like, well, really, it's a father-son movie with chess is just the vehicle for it. And that's not to say that there's all sorts of things in it, too. Obviously, Joan Allen's amazing as his mom and stuff, too. And
so
like
great.
Everything with his buddy Morgan and his sister. And like, and also, this movie gets kids right. Like, it so gets kids right. And so many movies do not.
Yeah,
it's
I totally agree.
So good. Just like the feel of everything. Little scenes. It's got little beats in it. So many little beats that when you watch it again, you'll be like, that is so good. That is so perfect. And, you know, I think people... I've never met anybody who didn't like it. If they've seen it, they're like, oh, I like that movie. There's never anybody I've met that's been like, ugh, what a bore. Or
no,
I couldn't get into
weird.
It. Like, it's just, I feel like it grabs you immediately and just doesn't let go. And it's a combination of everything. The acting, the script, the The score is beautiful. The James Horner music Gorgeous. Is so great. And the cinematography by Conrad Hall is yeah. so great. How do you make chess look good? Well, you put it in the yeah. park in the rain and yeah. it looks amazing.
It does.
And he got nominated for an Oscar that year for cinematography, but he lost to Janusz Kaminski for Schindler's List. So what, yeah. what are you going to do?
Exactly.
An amazingly shy, beautiful movie too. But it's just, there's just nothing in it that I don't like. There's nothing in it that I can say I don't like about that movie.
Yeah. Geez, there's a million things I want to talk about. What occurred to me today for the first time is that it's a sports movie.
Oh, yeah.
It is Rocky. It is Karate Kid. It is Hoosiers. But it's also Good Will Hunting and Finding Forrester and Dead Poets Society. It's got elements of all, and those are all movies that are just so dear to me. And it has elements of all those films. I feel like it does such a skillful job of dancing around tropes without fully going tropey.
Yeah,
but,
totally.
But tropes are comforting. Like, that's why there are tropes, because they work. And we make fun of them a lot, but especially on Movie Crush. But I think it veers toward tropey at times, but it knows just when to pull back. And there's a couple of instances that I can think of specifically. One is, just as a general plot device, they didn't make Joe Mantegna. He had his character arc, but he wasn't living his life through his kid. He yep. wasn't the guy that almost had it all, but didn't quite make it. And now his son has to do it. And they could have very easily done that. And the other big moment was at the end when he beats, and it's okay, we're going to jump all around, but at the end when he beats the jerk kid.
Trick or treat.
Who, by the way, that guy died of cancer at 18. Did you know that?
I did not know that. Wow.
Yeah, I looked him up and I was like, where did that kid go? And he very sadly passed away as a teenager. But after he loses, you see it through glass that is frosted, this sort of moment with his dad where he's sort of pulling away from him. But in another movie, that would have been sort of front and center in this big scene where he pulls away from his dad and is like, you made me do this and I lost now and all. And so it sort of dances toward that line, but just sort of hints at it, which I thought was really smart.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons I really love it is, like, I don't like unnecessary conflict in movies. I don't like things that, like, I don't like tension for the sake of tension. I really don't. Yeah. Like, one of my biggest pet peeves in movies in general is, like, embarrassment humor, I can't get behind it. I think because I have anxiety and issues like that too, like, I don't find Meet the Parents funny. I'm always just like, leave him alone. He's trying his best. Like, that's
right.
To me, like, that kind of stuff is hard for me to watch. There's not really moments of this in here. Like, whenever the adversity happens, it happens in a way that, like, this feels like it should happen, and it doesn't send characters reeling into a thing for X amount of time. Like, that's my problem with music biopics, is like, they almost always have a 20 to 30 minute section of rock bottom when they're right. in rehab. Where I was like, we know that that's going to happen. And there's no way to show it in a fresh, new, exciting way. It's just an awful thing to watch as they push their friends and family away and do all the other stuff too. Like, how about we just, like, gloss over that? Maybe go to, like, show one instance and say, like, 3 years later or whatever, and get back to the stuff that's more interesting to me. Unless that's what the movie is, fine. But in general, like, that kind of stuff makes me crazy. And you're right about that. Like, through the window from far away, it's not, like, really dwelled on.
Uh-huh.
And with his dad, with Fred, like, he's there's never that thing too that I also hate, when often it's like, this kid has a gift and he's like, no, he has to work on his studies, or he has, like, there's that whole thing.
Yeah.
Instead, like, at first he's just like, okay, kind of dismisses it initially, until it's very early proven to him when you want to go to the lake and kids beats him without even being in the room. He realizes, like, oh, okay, I get it now. My son has a gift and it's my job to cultivate that, but not make it the thing he does. And that's what I think is great about it too. It's a way to, like cultivate it and stuff like that too. But they have, like, rules of, like, there's no chess talk this weekend. We're just going to go swimming, or we're just going to be a kid. Like, that's what's amazing about it, is the protege kid obviously doesn't have be a kid. He just has a Rocky IV destroy, I will break you attitude.
Yeah.
Whereas, like Max Promax's character, like, Josh never has a mean bone in his body ever. Like, he's just a sweet kid. He's always a sweet kid. And I think that's what I like about it. And like when Morgan, his best friend, is like not at the same level of him in chess, but you know, he's a good chess player. Just like the whole, like the last line in the movie, and this doesn't spoil it, guys. Go and see it. He puts his arm around him and just says, "You're a much stronger player than I was when I was your age." Like it's such a sweet little moment to leave the movie.
Oh, God. It was so great. And they're just two little boys with their arms around each other. And he says that, and I'm just like, 10:15 in the morning, I'm just like bawling in my bedroom at the end of that movie. It was just so perfect. And the kid, was such a good actor. His had such an expressive face, and you're right. They get kids right. There's not a moment that feels false in this movie with him, or really at all, but especially with these kids, it's all so pure. They don't ask him to overact. A lot of times it's just his face that's conveying what would normally be a line. And he has those eyes, and it just works on every single level with these kids. One of my favorite moments of the whole movie is when they kick the parents out of the tournament and basically lock them in a jail in the basement, and all the kids start clapping.
They start clapping. Because
just get to be kids. It's just a wonderful moment.
And I think that's what's so good about his performance is just the, like, he's just being, it's so natural. It's so natural. There's no precociousness to it. There's nothing like, it's just,
that's the worst.
He's just a kid. Like when he's playing in his room and he's reaching under like his bed to find things and he disappears down there and stuff like that. It just feels so authentic.
My daughter just broke in.
Hey.
You want to say hi to Cole?
Hey, Cole.
Hey there.
This is Ruby.
Hey, Ruby.
She's been busting in lately, and I've just been kind of leaving them in the episodes. I heard you banging on the door, too. You want to say hi to everyone again?
I want to come in.
All right. Well, you can't come in from that way, and I'm going to have to ask you to go back upstairs now. Just because it's not a... it's not an episode where I can feature you. I'm very sorry. Thank you. She was banging on the back door, too.
It's been a rough one, sorry.
All right. I think maybe we'll just leave that in there because these have been quarantine episodes and everyone knows her by now. She's made appearances. So thank you for indulging that.
No, it's funny. It's just, we're literally talking about kids being natural and being kids. And then
I know. And there she goes.
We have a kid come in. I love it. The whole thing, just like that whole, everything is so natural to me in that movie. And like, and you're right about the tropes, like, cause you have like the streetwise teacher and you have the bookwise teacher. And like,
I mean, the formula is there, but formulas are okay. Like the reason that people write screenwriting books is because screenwriting is a super duper strict formula for the most part.
Yeah.
But like the Larry Fishburne character, like pre-Matrix, Larry Fishburne is my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
I love the Matrix, but before the Matrix, he was just a different guy, I feel like.
Yeah.
And he manages to pull off this role. Like, they don't have that trope of, I won't say what they'd normally call it, but sort of the magical black man that comes into the movie. They dance toward that, but he's not that. And the movie is much, much better for that, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Like, there's that one little wonderful scene, too, where, like, Josh asks his mom, like, where does Vinny sleep? Like, he just doesn't know. Like, he doesn't know about him. And she's like, I don't know. Like, that's just kind of how it's addressed. And, like, his character is great. Like, he definitely, like, I love the thing where it's like, what's your name? Don't tell him your name. Your kid's got, you know, he's got talent. I'm writing his name down right now. I saw him when, you know, that kind of thing. It's just.
Yeah.
And you know it's going to end up being the, like, he has to put together both styles to become the kind of player that he is. And, you know, he's going to bring his queen out too early if he wants to.
I know.
It's not a big deal.
It's great, though. It all works. Like, the Ben Kingsley character and the Larry Fishburne character, like you said, they're headed for a collision course in a way. But I think in the hands, I mean, Steve Zaillian, we haven't even mentioned the writer and director, one of the greatest writers in the history of writing movies, has only directed a few, but I think in anyone else's hands, this movie could have been really, really schmaltzy, but he has such a deft hand as a writer. I think he did not let it veer into those lanes.
And it was his directorial debut. So obviously, like, it was all his kid. And what I found out about the movie that I didn't realize about Zaillian is, like, I was just reading the liner notes of the soundtrack because I bought it on CD at the time because I loved it. And, like, I'm as weird as, like, I don't love classical music, but I love film scores. And I think it's because classical music puts me on edge, because there was always what was playing in the waiting room at like dentists and like doctors and stuff when I was a kid. So like I don't have pleasant memories associated with it. Whereas film scores I do, and some really good ones I just like, I love and I'll listen to over and over. It's weird which movies do. Like Gattaca has a great score, but you wouldn't say Gattaca has a great, you know, it's a great movie, whatever. But like this movie to me has one of the best scores. Like James Horner scores great. And I was reading in the liner notes that Steve Zaillian went to San Francisco State, which is where I went. And I didn't,
oh, no way.
I did not know that. So I used to do a thing back in college too, where I would write a lot of actors and filmmakers and stuff like that too. And they would often send me back like, you know, signed photos. I have a bunch of signed photos and stuff like that too, because I was definitely an autograph collector early. And some people would actually write me back and write letters. And I wrote him about like, you know, how much I love the movie and it's my favorite film. And I think at the time I was at San Francisco State, or I just graduated from it, and you know, I just found this out and it's so great and I love it. But I just wrote him, and he wrote me back and sent me a nice handwritten note, which I have in a thing someplace. But just basically saying means a lot. I love my time in San Francisco, whatever. So cut to me working at Second Spin here in Los Angeles, which is a used and new CD and DVD like Blu-ray place. Like Wilshire, where we would buy stuff, used things, and then sell them or whatever. That's how I built up my collection, because I would get things at like very cheap. A lot of DVDs and Blu-rays for $1, $2, whatever.
Yeah.
But celebrities would come in there because it's, you know, like it's Los Angeles. And one time this kid, teenage kid, was like buying something, and he gave a credit card. And the credit card said Steven Zaillian on it.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, Steve Zaillian, like the director, writer? And he's like, yeah, it's my dad. And I was like, please tell your dad hello for me and tell him that Searching Before Bobby Fischer is my favorite movie. And I thank him so much. He's like, he was really excited about it. And then like a couple of days later, he brought Steve Zaillian in with him, like brought his dad in just to say hello to me and was like, and to meet him. So like that was amazing. I mean, we just talked for like a minute or two, but
yeah,
it was still really cool. Like, it's just crazy the stories of people that would come in there. Because one time Janusz Kaminski came in and was buying up box sets, and I just looked at his, I didn't know it was him because I didn't know what Janusz Kaminski looked like, but I saw his credit card and, you know, Janusz Kaminski, and I was like, you lend movies beautifully. I love so much of your stuff.
Oh, man.
And he's like, oh, thank you. Like, he was very nice about it. Like, I didn't fanboy out. I don't think he gets it that often, you know? So,
yeah.
That was one of the weird benefits of like working at a retail store in Los Angeles, in a sense, where cinephiles would come in sometimes.
Totally.
So that's when I met Zaillian and stuff too, and through his kid initially, which was kind of funny too, because father son story met my filmmaking hero through father son connection. So yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. So I'm just going to read through some of the movies that he's written. The first movie he ever wrote was The Falcon and the Snowman. Amazing.
Oh, what a piece of shit.
Yeah. he follows that up with Awakenings, Schindler's List, Bobby Fischer, Clear and Present Danger, Mission Impossible, Civil Action, Gangs of New York, Moneyball, American Gangster, Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, The Irishman. It's just, that's an intimidating list.
Those
to look
are
over.
All great movies. I mean, you can argue that Awakenings might be the schmaltzy place that this could have gone, this movie, but I love Awakenings too. Awakenings is definitely like slightly manipulative, but I don't know if that's so much about the writing and more so about the way it's like done, directed. I love that movie though. Like, it gets me every time.
Oh, totally.
But yeah, he's amazing. He's one of the best writers out there for sure.
I have a quick Conrad Hall story. One of my favorite cinematographers of all time. And when I was a PA in Los Angeles on TV commercials, I worked a lot for his daughter. She was a commercial producer, Naya Hall. And Naya was just amazing. And I always just nerded out with her. And she loved how much I loved her dad's work, and really meant a lot to her. And she was just wonderful. And she, when he passed away, she asked if I wanted, or she asked for my help. But to me, it was an opportunity to go before his memorial service and kind of help her out and help put everything together and put up these posters and put up the flowers and all that stuff. And so she said I could stay. So I went to Conrad Hall's memorial.
That's amazing.
And just, and very much just hung back in the background, and like Tom Hanks was there and Spielberg was there. And it was a room that I never thought I would be in. And I literally didn't speak to anyone. I just just sat there like a fly on the wall and watched everybody. It was pretty cool.
It's amazing. It's hard to not want to call him Connie Hall, because I know that's what they all his friends called him. It's like, I don't know him. I can't call him Marty Scorsese. I can't call him Bobby De Niro. But that's always what pops into my head.
Yeah, but you mentioned how do you make chess exciting? And that opening and those opening scenes in the rain in the park, the sound design is really important in this movie too, how they're slamming those pieces down and hitting that clock. And it really gives it gives chess an energy that it might as well be Rocky or Karate Kid. It might as well be a prize fight that you're watching, or the final of a karate match. It's that thrilling, and it's totally due to the way he shot it and that sound design.
And it's also, like, especially then too, it's his way of doing a difference between street chess and like textbook chess. Because like Vinny's whole thing is like, you got to attack, you got to attack, you got to attack. You can't sit back. And Bruce's thing is more like, don't move until you see it. Don't move until you see it. Take your time. Don't move until you see it. That kind of thing. So it's very two different approaches. And Vinny's thing is like, move fast, catch your guy off guard, you know, that kind of thing. And so it definitely has that energy and that kind of street energy to it too. And, you know, it's the Washington Park in New York and that kind of stuff too. And
and did you know about that stuff then? By the way, because that was my first introduction to the fact that there were people like on the street playing chess in Washington Square Park. It really sort of brought it to me in a different light that I hadn't seen before.
I definitely had seen people play chess in parks, but didn't think about it. Like, I didn't really pay any attention. Like, oh, those guys are playing chess. Like, I didn't realize that, like, it's the same kind of thing as like people doing three card Monty in the corner or whatever. Like, it's kind of has this kind of hustler energy to it. And these guys that were either chess pros or ranked at some point now that just have kind of fallen out of favor, that are trying to just like earn a living by going out there, like the Russian chess master or whatever that he's with early, who's like, we'll give him a lesson for $5 and like that kind of whole thing. It's kind of really thrilling to see that. And like, it just kind of opens up that whole world that you're not aware of, like spelling bees or whatever. Like, it's that kind of thing of like just seeing the tournament footage too and that kind of stuff, and realize that this is a whole world. This is just like anything else. In terms of his competition, this could be a pageant. This could be horse racing. It doesn't matter. And like I said, like too, when they lock the parents up, it's like so many of the parents are like living vicariously through their kids in that. And it's not so much like Fred and Josh's relationship, which is what I like a lot.
Yeah. I mean, you briefly mentioned Ben Kingsley, and holy shit, Ben Kingsley's in this movie too. Right? Like, it's a murderer's row of actors in the main roles. And then all the way down, like, Tony Shalhoub has a 1 minute scene. A young Laura Linney has one of the best scenes in the movie, and she's in it for like a minute. William H. Macy's in it for a minute. Like, it's crazy the cast that he was able to assemble.
Oh, I know. Austin Pendleton and Dan Hedaya.
Oh yeah, Dan Hedaya's in it.
David Paymer. Like, it's just it's just chock full of people that. And I think a lot of them came out of the New York theater scene, probably knew Joe Mantegna and that kind of stuff too, but they're so good. And it's kind of interesting too, if you read up, like, a lot of those guys are playing versions of real people.
And right. Because this is a true story.
Right. It's based on a book that the Joe Mantegna character, his dad, Fred Waiskin, wrote about his son and that whole thing. But Austin Pendleton, in his one scene where he's kind of talking to himself and he's doing the board thing, he's playing a real chess master, and that chess master like didn't like the version of himself in it or whatever too.
Oh, really?
Which is interesting to hear about that. Like, but they interviewed Bobby Fischer at some point about it, and he never saw the movie, and he was upset that like he feels like he should have gotten paid some because they used his name and that kind of stuff too. But I was like, see the movie, dude. Like, he's not playing you. And if anything, like, I think it gives a lot of humanity to Bobby Fischer, because it kind of like all those interstitials about kind of what his journey was like too, and then how it mirrors like Josh and Fred's a little bit too. Like, I think it does a big service to himself and paints him in a positive light. But
yeah, I hear your cat, dude. I see your cats on Facebook. Your cats are the best.
Thank you. That's Sydney. He's the redhead's in the other room. Sydney's usually pretty chill, so I left him stay in this room, because I did a thing on Zoom the other night where, of course, one of the redheads popped up on the computer and completely ruined it. So I was like, hey, I'm not going to chance that right now.
Oh man, I love it. We call our we call cats rotten, because we have two rotten cats, and rotten cats are the best. We have two very weird cats now.
Yeah, they're awesome. Sydney's the old man. He's 14, And then the Redheads are now Rudy and Lucas are a year and a half now, I think.
Yeah, they're great.
So they have that kitten energy still, but they're starting to calm down a little bit.
Do they get along with the old one?
They do. We did it in the right way, I think. We isolated out the kittens in one room and then gave them another room and then reintroduced them slowly to each other. And they get along pretty well.
Yeah, that could be dodgy.
Yeah.
So the narration, you know, you mentioned the Bobby Fischer parts. Boy, that really just is the through line to this movie. That narration is so great. It always comes in at the perfect moment. And I can't imagine this movie without that stuff. I'm so glad that they, I guess, risked getting sued or whatever by showing that footage, the black and white footage. It all works so perfectly.
Yeah, it totally does. And you know, they always say like movies with narration are lazy, you know, like that's a screen trope they don't like a lot of filmmakers do. But like, it's not really narration. It's just like they're just these little moments that help fill in the gaps of everything else that's going on. It's you know, they could have started it with like, all my life I wanted to play chess.
Damn, that's different.
Brooklyn, 1926 or whatever. Like, it's not that. It's not Goodfellas or whatever. But
right.
And I think that's what's so great about it is like he's narrating his own story in a way without really narrating his own story. That's what's really cool about it.
Yeah, it was great. One of my favorite shots in the movie is, and it just like, it gives me chills when I see it and I rewound it like three times, is early on when he sets those Legos up as the chess characters in his castle and opens the castle door and the camera goes through.
Yeah.
Oh man, what a shot.
It's such like, it's just like a little glimpse inside a kid's mind. It's just, it's so great. And yeah, that's what I think is so wonderful about this movie is it just straddles like, here's the adult side, here's the kid's side, here's everything in between. And it doesn't treat anybody with contempt. It doesn't judge anybody, you know, even like the villain, so to speak, of like the grandmaster and his protege.
Yeah.
Like, if anybody complains about anything, it's that those characters are one-dimensional. I don't think that they are. I think that they're the least drawn of the characters in the film, but I think it's because they're not meant to be known. Like, they're not part of Josh and Fred's world. Like, what you see is what they see. It's just these little glimpses of them in tournament time. And, like, you actually learn a little bit about the guy he's against when he offers in the draw and how he's kind of stuck in that moment of, like, Why are you offering me this? Like, I don't understand.
Man, what
this.
A great moment in the movie with his little hand reached out. Like a little kid doesn't even know how to shake his hand. It's all like kind of stiff and straight.
Yeah.
And that was the one moment like they gave that kid that one moment where he said trick or treat, which is kind of out of character for him as a really sweet kid to kind of use that back against him.
Yeah.
But that moment where he says, like, you've already lost and, like, I'm offering you a chance to draw. And I don't know if I remembered when I watched it this morning, because I just saw this in 93, if he took him up on the offer. So there was genuine suspense again when I was watching that scene and I was going, take the deal.
Take the deal, kid. Walk away. Money in hand. Yeah, that's what's so great about it. Like, I feel like when he does do the trick or treat thing and he says it back and you're like, whoa, okay, shots fired.
Yeah.
It's almost like he realizes he has to stand up for himself in that thing and he has to dish back a little bit. That's him channeling Vinny a little bit in that moment.
Yeah.
That's him being like, okay, you've been trash talking me and everybody else you're playing against. I'm for real. I'm going to trash talk you back just for a moment. Just so you know that I can go toe to toe with you and I can dish out whatever you're going to dish out.
Yeah, that final match is,
right.
is so great.
Yeah,
there the shots of him. There's so many great opportunities for a chessboard with the rack focus shots, and there's so many great ones. But when they would rack from the chess piece back, and there's so much tension there, and Ben Kingsley is saying out loud what the moves are. I think it was like 12 moves or something like that.
Yeah,
and you see his eyes darting around that board, and Ben Kingsley's like, man, he's working it out. And Joe Mantegna's like, what's he working out?
Like when Ben Kingsley goes, that's a mistake.
Yeah.
Like, and he realizes it, and then you can see him just trying to like communicate with Josh mentally, being like, it's there, it's 8 moves away, but it's there, it's there, just don't move until you see it. It's like, this is my teaching now. Like, and then you can see that Josh is actually like, oh yeah, I'm gonna this is what Bruce did for me, and I'm going to wait until I see it, and I see it. And so that's when the draw thing happens and all that stuff. So it's just so, it's like, how do you make chess exciting? Uh-huh. They do. How do you put chess, like, because you to the somebody watching, you can't tell what's going on. You have no idea unless you have an advanced knowledge of chess. You don't. You can tell when, like, somebody's, like, if the camera shoots in a way that, like, well, the king's open, we know that that's going down or whatever.
Right.
But you don't know. And you and you don't want to do a play-by-play announcer being like, oh, Josh, with castling on the first move. We're crazy. Like, you can't do that.
Yeah.
So how do you do it in a way that the audience will have an idea of what's going on, at least enough to know? And I think Zillion was smart enough to know that, like, I don't need to explain the mechanics of chess. People don't need to know how he's beating them or what he's using a gambit or whatever. That doesn't matter. What I have to be able to communicate to them is that, like, is he doing well? Is he not doing well? Mm-hmm. What are the stakes? Where are we in that?
Yep, absolutely. And I think a lot of other, I think this in the hands of other people, it would have been way too on the nose, way too telegraphed. They probably would have had a fucking announcer in the room, like you said, like spelling out exactly what was going on. But you know exactly how much you need to know to follow the match and these peaks and valleys of that match. Kind of the same as... Karate Kid, which I think is a great, great movie. And that's what I think the best sports movies do, is you don't have to know anything or be a fan of the thing if you make a great movie.
Yeah, totally.
If someone says, I don't like basketball, so I've never seen Hoosiers, I'm like, no, you should see Hoosiers.
You should see Hoosiers.
It's a great, wonderful, great story. The same with boxing or karate or chess or anything else. If you do it right, you transcend the thing that the movie's about because the story is there.
Or even like Moneyball, which Zillion also wrote, like, you know, that's about, absolutely, that's about math in baseball.
Yeah.
Like,
I know.
I'm a big baseball guy. I love baseball. And I was actually at that. I've said this a billion times and Jenny will roll her eyes when she hears it. I was at that 20th win in Oakland when they won their 20th straight. So it was like,
are you an A's guy or Giants?
A's more than Giants. I think it's because when I was in Davis, we would drive to see A's games sometimes, but I like the Giants too. Like, I've gone, I'm a Tiger guy, like, it's because of my Detroit roots. So
It's
always been Tigers, but I definitely would go to Giants and A's games. And it's definitely the first, like, sporting event that I've seen reenacted on screen that I was at. That was really surreal to me too. But again, like, that's the thing, like, how do you make baseball transactions, like, fascinating? And, like, when you just see him working his magic on the phones in that movie, it's just like, it's crazy. It's like, it's almost Bobby Fischer again with chess, but now it's now it's numbers, baseball numbers.
Yeah, I'd like to see Moneyball again. That was a great movie.
Yeah, real good.
So a couple of my favorite, you were talking about the small moments in this movie and these small beats. There are a few lines and moments that just really are so touching and so great. One of them is when, again, outside in the rain, after he throws the tournament, and there's a great moment before that when he's in bed talking about not wanting to be the best, and you kind of know what's coming, you know, he's going to throw it.
Yeah.
But he's outside and he looks up at his dad and says, "Why are you standing so far away from me?"
That's just the most heartbreaking moment of the entire movie. And that's what, like, gets Fred too. Like, that's what it gets Joe Montana, where he's just like, "Oh, what am I doing?" Cause that whole sequence too is like, I love how they handle it when the little girl runs out of the room and he's like, "Oh, that was fast." Like, cause he's supposed to destroy her.
Right.
And it turns out it's the other way around, and, like, goes to her dad far away and starts celebrating. And then he's just like, no.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like his jaw just drops. And then it's like a rainy day when you're yelling at your kid about losing. Like,
yeah.
And that's when he realizes it's not about winning or losing.
Yeah. And that line just, I don't know if Zillion had kids then, but my daughter's almost 5. He's supposed to be 7 in the movie. And that's what a kid would say. Because they don't have the emotional processing ability at that age. All they know is dad is standing far away from him right now. And that's doesn't feel good. And, like, it's such a simple line, but just nailed it on the head, you know?
Yeah. No, it's crazy. I love it so very much.
Another one of the best lines is the great Laura Linney scene, where she's sort of condescending about this chess thing. And he's being the, you know, the sports dad sort of, But when he says, you know, he's better at this than anything I've ever done and anything that you will ever do, it's just such an eviscerating line.
It's so, yeah, it's so crazy. I mean, I especially love it too, like when Joan Allen has her moment, when Laura Linney's like, I had this chess thing, and like he's like, chess thing, and he wanders away, and like it's just that whole thing. I think that whole moment.
Yeah.
Laura Linney's like, or Joan Allen is so good in this movie, and like
she is.
You'd think it could be a thankless role because it's more so the mother, or the father son part of the thing, but she holds her own. She has amazing moments in this movie, and her little sister is so cute too. Like such a good little character. I love it so much.
Totally. And then the other two big moments for me is the scene where Ben Kingsley is telling him that he has to hate his opponents. And he said, Bobby had contempt for everyone. And he just said, I'm not him.
Right.
It's like a three word line and just sort of a masterclass in not overwriting.
And that's like so devastating too. And like he like tears up all the masterclass certificates that like,
yeah.
That's like the one thing he's like trying. He's doing this because he wants the praise too. And he's working so hard for this. And then to realize that in the eyes of his coach, it's nothing. You're nothing in a sense.
Yeah.
Like that's just, that's like one of the most heartbreaking moments too.
Well, and that pays off so well when he frames that really nice masterclass certificate, and he gives it to him before the last match, and he says, I've never been so proud of anyone in my life. I'm proud to call myself your teacher. And the kid goes, I'm scared. And he says, I know. And it, again, it's just not overriding. Like I like to, with some of my favorite screenplays and lines, I like to picture it on the page, and it's so sparse, but just pitch perfect.
And also the scene when they first start working together and they're playing games. And you think they're playing chess, and he's like, candlestick or whatever, and he's like, rope or whatever it was, and he's like,
They're playing Clue.
They're playing Clue, and then he's like, so are you guys talking about chess in there? No, didn't come up. Like, they're just playing games together, getting to know each other or whatever, and he's perplexed about, why is he in there playing board games with my son at $300 an hour or something, whatever it is.
Yeah, which again sort of dances on that trope of like Karate Kid. He's sanding the floor and waxing the car, but he's really learning karate. It's that, it's sort of that, it's tried and true in movies like this, and it works every single time if you do it right.
Right. Yeah, it's so beautifully done. I mean, this movie is just like, it's just, like I said, moment after moment. It's just little vignettes in a sense, like little things.
Yeah.
And that's why I think it rewards you with like repeat viewings, because you're going to pick up on things you didn't notice the first time through, because you're going to get caught up in different aspects of it. And, you know, I don't think it hurts to actually like listen to something like this, or like watch or read about it, or read about Bobby Fischer himself, or like I've heard the memoirs good. I have not read it. I don't think it will. I think it will change your perspective in some ways to like think of approaching it from a different viewpoint, to like watch it like you're like a kid, or watch it like you're a parent or whatever. I think it's just different every time you see the film.
Well, yeah. I mean, I watched it when I was in college, and then I watched it with a 5-year-old in my life, and it's definitely had more resonance. I loved it back then, but it had a lot more meaning, and it was a little deeper for me today.
And it's not on Blu-ray. It's a shitty DVD release from a long ass time ago.
No.
That just kills me. It's at least, thank God, it's widescreen on there, because there are some DVD releases earlier that are all full screen. You're like, what are you doing? Like, I just remember working at the video store and having to explain it to people, because we had Letterboxd VHSs for some movies, and we'd have a section called Letterboxd. You know, and we put them there. We put a thing on the side that said Letterboxd or whatever. And we would, like, when people would bring it up, we would explain it to them. And sometimes people would be like, so what is this? And be like, well, when films are shot, they're not shot in the 4:3. They're not shot like a square. They're shot like a rectangle. And this basically shows you the entire picture. There's black bars at the bottom and top of the screen, so that you're not getting a computer panning back and forth. So people are like walking down the sidewalk from far, like different sides of the street. You can see them both at the same time. I want to go through the whole rigmarole. And they go, oh, okay. And then they bring it back an hour later, being like, it's the top and bottom are cut off. And you're just like, you can't. There was no way to explain this to these people. They could not get their head around it.
No, I think the easiest way to have said it back then was like, compare your television screen to a movie screen, and that's the difference.
And still couldn't wrap their heads around it. So most things were full screen. Then they started coming out widescreen. Then thank God TVs just started being manufactured wide.
Yeah.
And now that's the norm and there's no way around that. But you can watch old DVDs and stuff from like movies from the 80s that never got a good like version ever put out. Like Short Time, I have like a boot version of, which is a great movie, but like it's not out there and it's a shitty little 4:3 grainy, awful like version of that movie. But hey, at least I can watch it. But you can put those things in it and it just looks so god awful that I can't imagine watching anything not widescreen anymore, unless it was shot that way. I mean, a lot of old movies weren't shot wide, but
right. And now the fight we have to fight is the motion smoothing it to the in-laws' house.
Oh god, every time I go home I turn that off and somehow it resets sometimes. It just makes me
dude
crazy.
Like, I did that for years at my father-in-law's when we would go for Christmas. Now they live here, so I don't bother because I don't watch TV over there, but I would sneak over and grab that fucking remote and it would somehow be changed back the next day.
It, oh my God. Like when the movies would start that way, I was like, do you realize this doesn't look like a movie anymore? And it looks like somebody who's recording a soccer game with a camcorder, right? You realize that's what this looks like now?
Yeah. They don't get it. They think it looks super clear. And I'm like, super clear isn't necessarily great.
Awful. Like I get it if you were watching football, but it's
right.
Terrible for movies. Movies should look like movies.
Yep. Anything else on Bobby Fischer, man? I think that was a good discussion. Thoroughly enjoyed that.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it's hopefully people will go find it. It's been on cable lately. Like, it's been on, I think, like Showtime or Starz. It's been playing because I've caught it a few times. So when people do check this out, they might be able to find it someplace. I don't know if it's streaming or whatever, but they should.
It's not. I got it on iTunes Movies and, you know, it looked fine.
Cool. They should definitely seek it out because I think a lot of people haven't seen it. And
agreed.
People always find it weird that it's my favorite movie because I'm a big comedy guy. I mean, that's how I make my living is in comedy. And like, I love comedies. I could go on and on about comedy, but like, this is the movie that touches me more than anything else. And I'll defend it till the end of time. And it's just like,
it's great.
A little sleeper of a movie that more people should have seen and it should have done better than it did. But at least I do think it is appreciated with those who have seen it and who love it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I get your stuff on Facebook. I'm not on Twitter, but I'm sure your Twitter handle is a fun follow because you are, especially for our listeners, because you are a true movie buff and movie nerd and connoisseur and have a lot of great stuff. So where can people find you?
They can find me at both Instagram and Twitter, which, I mean, obviously with the movie posters and stuff. I usually put them on both, but I definitely put them all on Instagram, which I believe is Stratton Cole, and then Twitter is Cole Stratton. So it's pretty...
okay.
Pretty easy. It's one or the other.
All right.
But yeah, they're all kind of up there and stuff, and I'll continue to post movie shit all the time.
That's great, man. I appreciate you coming on. Janet was my inaugural guest on this show, and now I've gotten you in here, and I would love to just have you back to talk about anything at some point.
Would love to do it. I could talk movies forever. So there you go.
All right. Well, thanks, buddy.
Awesome. Thanks, Chuck, man. Means a lot.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.